This is Scenic Roots. This afternoon on Talking Writing, our guest is poet, teacher, and most recently graduate student, Cynthia Robinson-Young. Cynthia is an adjunct professor of special education at Covenant College, but she's spending much of her time at the moment working on her first novel, which she hopes to complete by sometime in the spring. This is the second part of our conversation. The first part was on Scenic Roots the week before last. It's on the radio station website if you missed it. We began with Cynthia reading a poem she hasn't yet published.
Now you see me. I was raised to be invisible, to hide from the boogeyman, to not go with strange men, even if they were called uncle. To walk away from a lover after the first slap, when he said, "Baby, I didn't mean it, but you made me do it." But I was also raised to be a good daughter, to not take up too much air, to do what I was told without looking back. And so I sat in that barber's chair for a facial, and I, hungry for perfection, let him put his hands on my teenage face, covered with perceived imperfections, all distorted in the bathroom mirror. But I didn't want his hands to roam down to my chest, barely budding. Good thing I was raised with black girl magic, with the power to leave that chair, to run from the boogeyman, to be strong enough to tell, to raise my voice, to scream.
While I wasn't raised to be invisible, the rest of it resonates. I know exactly what you mean. I know exactly what you mean.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's a very disturbing feeling when you're small, surrounded by adults, and you're not sure if they can be trusted.
Right, right.
Did you have that experience very often?
Well, I feel like there's a lot of truth in this poem, because I feel like as children, especially in, you know, our home, we're like, you're supposed to be seen and not heard, and, you know, you don't interrupt adult conversations, and, you know, you just stay as invisible as you can. And then just the whole thing about if you're not invisible, bad things can actually happen to you, you know.
So. It's funny you say that, because that's exactly the household I grew up in. My grandfather, especially my mother's father, he and my grandmother spent a lot of time with us in the house when we were children, because my mother was working, and so they'd come and take care of us during the holidays. And he was very Victorian, and that was absolutely his philosophy. Why am I hearing from these children? What have they got to tell me? Children were meant to be seen and not heard. I can't tell you how many times I've heard that one.
Yeah.
Another of your poems that resonated, I think, probably as much as anything because of the conversations we've had before, because you didn't grow up in the South, I don't think, did you?
No.
So your poem, Jericho Revisited, the whole time I was reading it, it kept flashing on conversations we've had about why you came back here and how you felt about it when you did come back here.
Yeah. That was another poem that when it got workshopped, you know, with my white poet friends, they weren't sure, especially what was happening. Like, wait, what? But I love this poem, and I just believed in it. And then that got accepted by an African-American journal who, you know, they read it and they got it right away, you know.
Jericho Revisited. 1. Running away through oak and pine, my ancestors' nightmares continue in my dreams. And as dreams go, I am catapulting through time and space. I am in Newark with my father, circa 1959, surrendered, safe. Then suddenly in the New South, black landscaped again. Us, all moneyed up now. I am migrating back to what was once feared, returning because I want safety in the place that was never safe. We want the ghosts of bygone days purged. The land my great-grandparents slavishly worked appears peaceful. Still, I hesitate at the border. This southern soil has called me back for retribution, for reparation, for all that was promised. Two. We want to partake freely with southern richness, like cold buttermilk and hot cornbread. We stand in our tribes, waiting for our inheritance. Our ancestors have led us back to their promised land. It has already been surveyed by the first to return. They saw the monuments, the statues, like giants commemorating our enslavers, celebrating their effort to hold us down. We feared we might once again wear the mask, but we are blended and bonded now. We are all colors of peach and tan and brown and black, and we don't hate ourselves or each other for it. See us marching around that southern wall. Hear us playing our saxophones and trumpets, beating our snare and conga drums. Watch us dance our dances, the cakewalk juba and bop, Charleston camel walk and chicken step.
We're coming back to the South, and we want to change it. We want to get back to what it should have been.
The southern soil has called me back for retribution, for reparation, for all that was promised.
Yeah.
Such a fractured history.
But, you know, I love it. Yeah, I love the South.
I know. You can. Yeah. That's apparent. And the next verse, we want to partake freely from southern richness, like cold buttermilk and hot cornbread. We stand in our tribes waiting for our inheritance. Our ancestors have led us back to their promised land. So this was your land, in as much as your family.
Yeah, well, you know, like generations. Obama says, we built it. Yeah, so many things we built, but didn't get to, you know, in that wealth that came from all the work that African American slaves did.
How would you feel if you built a house and somebody told you you couldn't live in it?
Right. And that's basically was our lives.
Right. And then there's the Walnut Street Bridge.
The Walnut Street Walking Bridge. Chattanooga, Tennessee. They thought in the year of 2010, they could close the bridge and recreate it, paint it hate blue to keep its evil past away, dedicated to wash away its sins. But the generations of Black Chattanoogans will not forget what happened on the night of March 19th in 1906. And the elders still say it is haunted, still say that on foggy nights, they can see Ed Johnson hanging from the noose he wore for the crime he bore, the violation of a white woman. The payment? A convenient black man. A prisoner of mob law, he was noosed at the jail and dragged to the bridge. Now, on stormy nights, when the river is restless, the elders say they can hear the splash of his blood cutting water. And on the 4th of July, amid the fireworks celebrating freedom, They hear the 55 gunshots, forgiving the murderous mob. Last words choked out, a benediction echoing across all these years. God bless you all. I am an innocent man. If all that is needed to be my judge, jury, and executioner is to be a different color, to speak a different language, to have different ideas, to believe in a God you cannot see, then I could be a gory decoration, a mob left abased and hanging from a poplar tree, hidden in a forest, or dangling from a cursed bridge in the middle of a city, for even the children to see. I could be Ed Johnson.
What's going on with that statue they're supposed to be putting up? I thought that was supposed to be up already.
Well, I know they're working on it because for Juneteenth, they had a, what do you call it? Well, a march across the Walnut Street Bridge. And I took my daughter and my son with me and to participate in that. And we had to congregate on one side of the bridge because they said the other side of the bridge was being worked on with the memorial for Ed Johnson. So I said, oh, good. They're working on it at least. So probably the COVID didn't help, you know, it go any faster. But the way I understand it, they are still working on it. Yeah, I haven't been down there since whenever on that side. I haven't really gone downtown. I'm mostly staying home because of COVID.
So, yeah, talk about the boogeyman.
The boogeyman, yes. We can't see him, but everyone's supposed to be terrified.
Actually, you know, thinking about it, Cynthia, and looking at your poetry again, it would seem to fall into two streams, really. There's those that are immediately personal, even though they're universal, like Cornered, for instance.
Cornered. I have stood on corners, shaking with fear and cold, waiting with my sister on a northeastern November night, neon blinking Budweiser in a ghoulish light on our young black faces. My sister wasn't old enough to protect herself, so how could she protect me? The boys who could be men were coming toward us. The street lamp lit up the mischief in their eyes, and I wish the light would hypnotize them and hold them at that halo until our mother could come out of the bar to rescue us. But the bar windows were tinted dark. No one is meant to see through them. Dark enough to protect the ones inside who start their drinking early in the day and stop early in the next. Our mother did not do that. She was not like that. She was the mother who says, I'll only be a minute. Just wait right here in the corner by the door. You'll be safe. I'll be right back out. We had to believe her. She was our mother. We had no choice. The men who could be boys were saying things our mother would never allow her daughters to hear. She would have shut them up. She would have washed their mouths out.
I'm not sure there are many people, sadly, who haven't had something akin to that experience at some point in their lives, where they've been on the street and usually boys or young men in a group coming the other way feel threatening. I certainly can relate to that. I grew up in London, as I said, in the 60s, and there were young people basically divided into skinheads and people who weren't skinheads.
Right.
And if your hair was long, so much the worse, because you're almost certainly going to be a target. So I know how that feels. I don't know how it feels to you, but I know how it felt to me.
Mm.
So there's that, a poem like that, or you know, about your mum naming you after the moon. It's interesting, really, I guess, as with everything in life, it's kind of on a spectrum, because not just to have the bluest eye could be read either way. It's very personal, and yet at the same time, for a African-American person, that seems to be pretty universal.
I think it's always been an issue that because of what we've gone through, that the lighter of the skin, the more acceptable.
But that would seem to be, you know, because the power structure was largely white. So the closer
right.
you resemble the power structure, the more likely
exactly.
it is that you're going to be unmolested and gain entree.
Right. So it would seem anywhere where there was colonialism, that should maybe be the case, but I don't know.
But you have been looking at Nigerian writers, I think, right? Does anybody talk much about that in their work that you've seen?
Not the books that I'm reading are more, actually they're centered more around wars, Nigerian wars, and the family structure there. And what I've loved about it, especially this one book that I'm reading right now called The Fisherman, it really deals a lot with the African and Nigerian family and culture. And I'm like, this is just like African-American culture. So it's interesting how much of our DNA has just, you know, stayed with us, that we still even raise our children, have those same values, you know, that African parents have. You know, we haven't lost that. We still are one in many areas, even though we've had different experiences.
That's interesting. Is that a result of received wisdom? Is that the kind of, you know, advice that you got from your parents and your grandparents?
Yeah, I wonder. I mean, I wonder if it just got passed down. You know, and to the point that we haven't been conscious of it, but it's been a subconscious passing down of values and just how we look at our family, how we look at our children, you know, what kind of value do we place on community, things like that.
Yeah. That makes that whole notion of African American that much more resonant, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Why did you start looking at Nigerian writers?
So you know this because of migration, but I've been like really trying to get into the family history, and so, you know, having my DNA done. And Ancestry.com is saying that I am 43% Nigerian, as far as, you know, the bloodline. So I'm like, well, I should see what's going on, you know, since, you know, it's that high a percentage. So then I just started, you know, reading more Nigerian history and culture, especially the fiction, and just loving it. Oh, my goodness. Just loving it. Just the beauty of the language, the proverbs and folk tales that are just embedded into the culture along with Christianity. It's really fascinating. So, yeah, that's how it came about. I'm really enjoying learning more about it. And I have my son, my youngest son, has a Nigerian middle name. And so when he's around other Nigerians at college, they get really excited. They say, oh, you have a Nigerian name. And so he has friends that are Nigerian too. So it's fun. I wish I knew more, but, you know, I'm working on it.
I understand. As I say, I've lived in America almost exactly 50 years. A couple of years shy of it at the moment. There are so many subtle differences between British and American culture. And even after 50 years, there's still this sense that even if it's unfamiliar, it's familiar.
Right, right.
I think perhaps the same is true for you.
Yeah, yeah. Definitely.
That's an interesting kind of mystical thing about who we really are, you know?
Yeah. So this book, The Fisherman, it centers around four brothers, and they remind me so much of my sons and how they would relate to each other. And so that's another thing that resonated with me and why I just really have enjoyed that book in particular. Just how, you know, how that family's trying to raise these sons and the values they put in them are the values that I tried to instill in my sons. And, you know, I don't think I've been as successful as they were, but because it's a fiction, they weren't that successful either. But, yeah, kind of, oh, my goodness.
Why did you decide to write a novel?
Well, as I said, I heard that story from my aunt. And so I've been thinking about it and thinking about it, like, you know. And then when my, you know, other aunt said it wasn't true, and I'm like, well, what if it was, you know? And it's just been fun, you know, trying to figure out how to integrate what I know about my family, you know, what I know about Nigerian culture, what I know about the South. I'm trying to integrate all of that. And then I needed a thesis. So I found my novel thesis. So
and
that's why I'm doing it.
The novel was a better form to tell that story than a poem.
Yeah. Well, yeah, they don't. What happened at UTC is that they kind of phased out the poetry, the poetry concentration when I got there. And so I felt like I could get more help from the fiction professors that were there. So that's why I decided to go that route. And they have been helpful, so, yeah.
Has having written so much poetry helped you at all in writing fiction?
I was thinking about that. Because, you know, with this COVID, for some reason, for the first time in my life, it started giving me writer's block. I think I'm just stressed out from, you know, what is, you know, not just the COVID, but everything is like, what is going to happen next? So, you know, the big things being the Black Lives Matter, the COVID, the elections, and whatever else is going to happen when we wake up tomorrow that we can't handle, you know, and it's just like, I can't write. All I can do is read. So, but I've been wanting to write, because when the COVID started, I wrote every day in April and came up with some really good work because I was really feeling things. But now I've almost become numb, I feel like. And so hopefully I'm reading, because that's one thing you do when you can't write, you just gather information by observing the world. And so I'm reading and I'm walking. And I'm hoping that all that creative whatever is coming together. And when I sit down to write the novel and to hopefully write more poetry. It'll be there ready. Because right now I got nothing.
I guess it's the most frustrating thing about any creative endeavor is, as much as we like to think we can control it, we really can't. It's either there or it's not. And if it's not there, there's a reason it's not there. And it's not that it's not there.
Right, I mean, there's fights, you know, there's a lot of, disagreement about that. Some people say you still have to sit down and put something on paper. And then some people say, you know, this might be the time of gathering. So I feel like I, land on the ladder, that maybe there's a time to gather in your body and your, subconscious what you want to write about, instead of forcing something to come out that's stupid.
I think so. I think so. I'm not sure I've completely thought this through, but it strikes me that it's the same in anything in nature, whether it's our bodies or the earth. Nothing produces constantly. There has to be fallow times in order for there to be productive times.
Oh, yeah.
She named me after the moon. My mother named me after a moon goddess, for she hoped I would at least light my own path, not trip over too much of life's debris, and certainly not trip others. When I told my family what I saw the day the clouds fell down and emptied the sky, soft pillows blanketing 1959 Plymouths and Cadillacs, until nothing was left except baby blue above, and everyone dismissed it as fog, my mother never doubted the visions I could see. I was her daughter, child of the moon, who chose not to read messages unless lit by starlight. My mother named me after a moon goddess who was born on a mountain with her twin brother. They say if you are born alone and left-handed, you had a twin, a ghost sibling who got lost. I am left-handed, and I've always known someone was missing. When the clouds fell from the sky on the morning of that summer day, I know my twin would have believed me, because he would have been right beside me, peering up into that cloudless baby blue, touching the soft pillows that were like the fog on Lookout Mountain, but too heavy even to hold, my twin and I, loony together. When the yellow moon is round and confident, we still converse, our words starlit. I feel the ghost, and he sees them. He brings me their stories, and I sing him their songs. He has seen what Martin Luther King dreamed. His soul has already taken that look back and knows how we got over.
Cynthia Robinson Young with the one and only Richard Wenham. You're listening to Scenic Roots on WUTC.